Here it's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. As many as 500 residents of Marinette County are getting access to nearly $10 million to pay for PFAS remediation. The state's Joint Finance Committee voted this week to release the funding that came from a June settlement with Tyco Fire Products in a lawsuit over PFAS contamination in the area. Local residents like Doug Oitzinger of Marinette told WPR they were happy to see that money released in a timely manner.
We're appreciative of everybody that was involved in making it go forward. You know, it's an election year, and there was no guarantee that the Joint Finance Committee was even going to meet.
The DNR held listening sessions in Marinette to determine how that money should be used. The majority of it is going toward providing safe drinking water to owners of private wells contaminated by PFAS. We're checking in on the latest developments in the state's ongoing battle with these so-called forever chemicals and what challenges still remain. WPR reporter Danielle Kading covers environmental issues. She's been following this story. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Danny, can you give us a brief overview of the lawsuit that was settled here between the state and Tyco that brought in this $10 million?
Yeah, sure. You know, 4 years ago, the Wisconsin Department of Justice sued Johnson Controls International and its subsidiary, Tyco Fire Products, over allegations they violated the state spills law. And the reason for that was that Tyco didn't notify the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources for years of PFAS contamination around its fire training facility in Marinette. But the company has said that they thought that that contamination was confined to their site.
How long have residents in the area been dealing with PFAS contamination and unsafe drinking water?
You know, that's not as clear. I mean, what we do know is that Tyco and the company's predecessor, Ansell, had been using firefighting foam that contained these chemicals since the 1960s until 2017 when the state was notified. So it's been almost a decade since residents became aware of it.
What have they been dealing with then on the ground? What has that meant for the daily lives of people with contaminated wells?
Yeah, over the years, you know, we've heard over and over again about how people have had to use bottled water or install in-home treatment systems. Tyco has helped with some of that, but not all, including in an expanded area around the company's facility.
What do we know about the breakdown of what some of that money will be used for?
Yeah, so that money will be used for installation of deep wells, the bulk of it anyway. And that's for, again, those residents in that larger area around Tyco's facility that the company wasn't required to address. And money will also go to testing, treatment, and blood serum testing for PFAS. And state health officials are budgeting for about 200 blood tests. And then some of that money will also go for a local liaison to work with residents.
For your reporting, Danny, you talked to some Marinette County residents about the money coming in from the settlement. Here's a listen to former Town of Peshtigo Board Chair Cindy Boyle.
Those folks in the expanded site investigation area definitely needed some additional support and resources. And so fortunately, the settlement dollars will be earmarked for our community and we'll be able to go to help those people.
Are local residents happy with the settlement money and the process of the turnaround time, or do they feel like more needs to be done?
Well, what I've been hearing is that they're happy about the quick turnaround with the funds in this case, but some have continued to say that they're unhappy with the amount and the terms of the settlement. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call has said it's one of the largest deals handled, or it is the largest deal handled exclusively by the state, but residents thought there should be more money, and they wanted to see Tyco forced to handle the cost of wells testing and treatment in that larger area.
This is Marinette County. That's not the only community dealing with this kind of pollution. Earlier this year, Governor Evers signed a bipartisan compromise with the state legislature. It set the framework for spending over $100 million to address PFAS contamination. What is the status of that funding?
Well, we haven't seen that go out yet. Last I heard is that the DNR is working through the process of getting things ready for a community grant program and hoping to issue guidance so that communities can begin applying for those funds in late October.
Danny, thanks again for bringing us up to date.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
That's WPR reporter Danielle Kading with us today to share the details of the state's Joint Finance Committee releasing close to $10 million for PFAS remediation in Marinette County. That stems from a lawsuit settlement with the company Tyco. Now we'll take a closer look at what that money could go toward, how the battle with PFAS continues in various parts of the state. Dave Strifling is an associate professor of law and director of the Marquette University Law School Water Law and Policy Initiative. Dave, welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Rob. Glad to be here again.
$10 million sounds like a lot of money. How far does that go when we're talking about cleaning up PFAS, providing safe drinking water alternatives and deeper wells, as we just heard, to residents in an affected community?
Time will tell, I think, is the only answer to that. As Danielle said, there certainly are some in the community who think it won't go far enough when you look at the rising costs and whether enough area is included in the settlement. And on the other side, Tyco probably thinks it was more than they wanted to pay. So the only thing we can do is wait to see how far that money will go.
Whether we're in Marinette County or elsewhere in the state, what is the process like when it comes to testing wells to see if they're contaminated, replacing them, or providing in-home remediation for PFAS-affected water?
Yeah, there are a few different routes that affected residents can take here. The first step, obviously, is to get the well sampled, and that can take some time, of course, but once that happens, they can opt for either installation of a deep well or a point of entry treatment system if they don't want to go through the trouble of having a well installed. So all in all, this is a process that could take months, if not longer.
How long does it take for that initial PFAS pollution to make its way into groundwater, into the sort of groundwater that people are relying on for their private wells?
Groundwater is sort of a mysterious beast, I think. It moves, obviously, much slower than surface water does. So in some areas, it can move very, very slowly, you know, feet per year. In other areas, it can move more quickly, depending on the particular conditions in the area. That's what makes it so difficult to really measure, because it's not intuitive in the way that surface water is. We can't just look at it. So it really requires a lot more study than some other parts of contamination like surface water.
We're focusing on Marinette County today because that's the latest settlement. There are so many communities around the state affected, other lawsuits. How common is a concern about PFAS pollution around the state?
I think it's something that's concerned throughout the state for all of our residents. And, you know, one of the really big things I think that this settlement illustrates is the importance of the courts and the law in governing these disputes. You know, we saw just last summer a dispute make its way all the way up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Question there was whether WDNR had to promulgate individual rules for individual PFAS contaminants under the spills law, which, as Danny reported, is the basis, the core of this dispute, this settlement. And if that case had had a different outcome, we wouldn't have seen this settlement at all. So I think that is going to be really critical for future disputes throughout the state.
That's an important point we've talked about before on the air, Dave. We say PFAS. Well, that's not one chemical. It's a class of chemicals with lots of subcategories and different chemicals. How difficult does that make it to try to regulate these?
Well, again, if that Supreme Court decision last summer had gone the other way, I think it would make it almost impossible, because, you know, what we've seen in Wisconsin is that to promulgate an administrative rule from beginning to end can take years, 2 to 3 years in some cases, once you go through that whole process. So if DNR had had to do that for each individual PFAS, and there, as you said, we're talking about potentially tens of thousands of chemicals, it would be pretty unworkable from an administrative standpoint.
This Marinette County settlement, do you see this as a one-off with very particular details, or could this be a model for other communities around the state?
Well, this is certainly the one everyone's been watching. As Attorney General Call said, this is kind of the biggest thing the state has ever done when it comes to environmental settlements with the state acting alone. So I'm not sure that there's anything this large immediately on the horizon. But when it comes to those smaller cases that we're going to see popping up, certainly the terms here could serve as something of a model that the state could adapt for smaller cases.
This whole conversation so far, Dave, is about PFAS chemicals that have entered the ground and the groundwater over the last years, over the last decades. How about now when it comes to new pollution? What kind of things have changed? Have things changed to where we're not going to be talking about pollutants that are going into the ground today, but what, 10 years from now?
Right. There are a couple of levels to that discussion. One is just focusing on PFAS. And certainly we're seeing some states across the country do different things when it comes to regulating PFAS, all the way up to banning them from incorporation in new products. And that's certainly one way to handle this. So, to the extent PFAS are still entering the waste stream, we're going to see these type of contamination episodes come up in different places from time to time. But the other aspect of this is all sorts of different emerging contaminants beyond PFAS, things that we don't even know about yet that we should be concerned about. And again, this can be a model for settlements related to those types of contaminants in the future. And that court case that I mentioned earlier is going to be really critical because even though it concerned PFAS, I don't think it's specific to PFAS. It's broad enough to cover those other types of chemicals and really gives DNR pretty broad authority over those emerging contaminants in the years to come.
Now, we've been talking about people here affected with private wells, a lot of people around the state. But of course, more people around the state have some kind of municipal system where the water is treated. What do we know about those communities, whether PFAS is being screened out of drinking water when it goes through that municipal system?
It's a concern everywhere. The difference is that those who are being served by municipal systems are going to have the protections of the Safe Drinking Water Act. And we're seeing at the federal level and filtering down to the state level, at least limits for a couple of the most common types of PFAS that are going to govern those systems. The issue with private wells is that they were not subject or are not subject to Safe Drinking Water Act protections. That's why it was so critical to protect those residents who rely on private wells. And as you said, that's a lot of people in Wisconsin to protect them by other means. And DNR is working on that too by promulgating a rule that will govern or set up standards for PFAS in groundwater. But that's not quite finished yet at this.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us. That's Dave Strifling, Associate Professor of Law and Director of the Marquette University Law School Water Law and Policy Initiative, with us today to share what PFAS remediation efforts look like, what work still needs to be done to clean up these forever chemicals from drinking water in the state. We also heard from WPR reporter Danielle Kading about the $10 million in settlement funds released by the state's Joint Finance Committee for Marinette County. Coming up, a new study finds that a quarter of former NFL players are at risk of a serious brain illness. What does that mean for youth sports? A Wisconsin researcher tells us what we can and can't learn from that study.
We don't know how much these findings of this study translates or generalizes to other populations at lower levels of play.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. A cheeseburger is an iconic part of any late summer cookout, and for many people, American cheese is critical to achieving that desired gooey melt. As consumers shift away from processed foods, one Wisconsin company is hoping its natural cheese version of the processed classic will keep the tradition alive. Hope Kerwin has more on the new product and why American cheese has stayed so popular through the years.
Every summer, Rudy's Drive-In in La Crosse brings diners back to another era. Car hops on roller skates balance frosty mugs of root beer and baskets of food. On the griddle inside is another relic, slices of gooey American cheese melting over burgers.
It's just the way it melts. You get the string pull off it.
Owner Justin Smith says American cheese is a key part of the nostalgia of Rudy's, and its performance in the kitchen is unmatched.
Use it on our chili dogs too, just the way it looks. Melts down, it's perfect.
Processed cheese was once seen as the way of the future, rising to popularity during the age of TV dinners and other convenience items. But in recent years, consumers are moving away from products considered artificial in favor of clean-label foods with fewer ingredients. The movement has recently been in the spotlight thanks to the Trump administration's focus on reducing consumption of ultra-processed foods. Now, Wisconsin cheese company Sargento is hoping to capture the best of both worlds by giving nostalgia seekers a real cheese alternative to American cheese. Here's Rod Hogan, Sargento's Senior Vice President of Innovation.
You know, really took processed cheese, or what people love about processed cheese, the way I think about it, updated it for the way Americans are eating today.
their new natural American cheese debuted on store shelves across the country last year. And to understand why this product is in a league of its own, cheesemaker Lloyd Metzger says you have to understand the science behind processed cheese.
So it's really literally all about the melt.
At a molecular level, natural cheese is a loose network of proteins with milk's butterfat trapped inside. But Metzger, who's considered the leading expert on processed cheese, says this fragile protein structure is compromised when the cheese melts.
So you'll see, you know, literally butter fat start to come out of it, and you'll see this stringy, kind of gloppy mess.
He says processors discovered they could avoid this separation by forcing the milk proteins to latch directly on to the fat. The process involves mixing melted cheese with an emulsifying salt, changing the chemistry of the product altogether.
Now when you remelt it afterwards, it's going to be this beautiful, smooth, even, velvety melt that you won't ever get out of natural cheese.
Metzger says what's exciting about Sargento's new product is that it forms this protein-fat pairing without using the emulsifying salt or the cooking process. According to John Rogers, Sargento's vice president of research and development, it took roughly a decade of trial and error to get the science just right. At the company's technical center in Elkhart Lake, he mans a flat-top griddle to demonstrate what he calls the gold standard for American cheese performance, a grilled cheese sandwich.
I think the team here at Sargento has probably made thousands of grilled cheese to get to the point that we're at with Natural American, for sure.
He butters slices of bread and adds the Natural American. After toasting on each side, along with a few minutes steaming under a lid, it's ready for me to try.
That's a good grilled cheese. That melt is definitely, you can tell the difference.
The taste and feel of the creamy golden center takes me right back to my childhood days of Kraft Singles. Hogan from Sargento says that's the whole point. For years, their company has been slowly converting the people who grew up on American cheese to natural. That always meant sacrificing the mild flavor and even melt of processed cheese.
So now we want to give the natural cheese user the option to come back into a category that they actually love.
He says their new product is shelved right next to the processed slices, hopefully making it clear to consumers that it's a new, natural take on the beloved classic. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is WPR News. The head trauma-related brain disease, CTE, can be fatal. Chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, likely comes from repeated head injuries where nerve cells in the brain degrade over time. The disease has made headlines over the years as it affects football players and other athletes in high-impact sports. New research published in the health journal, the BMJ, now suggests at least one quarter of all NFL players could get the disease in their lifetimes. Research into head trauma and its connections to dementia later in life have roots here in Wisconsin. Our next guest has been a co-investigator on a number of studies into the connections between traumatic brain injuries and their chronic effects. Dr. Benjamin Brett is a clinical neuropsychologist and associate professor of neurosurgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He spoke with WPR's Brady Carlson.
To start, what's your main reaction to this five-year study confirming CTE in one out of four of the NFL players who died during the period of the study?
Yeah, my main reaction is one of surprise, probably similar to the general public. I think, you know, there's an important number of limitations and caveats that should be considered when interpreting the main headline of the story, but I do think it's an important finding and step forward towards understanding the rate and prevalence of CTE, neuropathological change, in former football players and contact sport athletes in general.
When you're talking about caveats, what comes to mind for you?
It's important. There's a couple things when reading the results of the study to keep in mind as you interpret the results and try to apply them to different populations across levels of play or different sports. And the first thing to consider when reading through the results of the study is the need to separate the pathology from the clinical symptoms and the syndromes. So CTE, neuropathological change, is the presence of a neuropathology on autopsy. It's a contributor to brain disease, or is a brain disease that contributes to neurodegeneration, But that is different from many clinical signs and symptoms and even diagnoses of dementia. And it's important to not equate the two, that having the presence of this pathology means definitive diagnosis of dementia or cognitive impairment or psychiatric diagnoses.
So essentially, there's a range of people who can be diagnosed and confirmed as having CTE. It doesn't necessarily mean that every single one of them spends a portion of their life dealing with dementia or some of these worst case, these really severe cases that we sometimes hear about.
Absolutely. And even in the results from the study, you see that people with stage 3 CTE on autopsy have a neurodegenerative diagnosis or a diagnosis of dementia anywhere from 18 to 50%. So that's stage 3 CTE. That's a relatively advanced progression of the neuropathological change. And even those with that stage and level of progression, there's still a ton of variation in terms of who is experiencing cognitive impairment and decline from a functional standpoint.
But with a headline like this, which also notes that 25% of players may be the floor, not the ceiling for CTE, does that then start the phones ringing in offices like yours, players or former players calling up and saying, what does this actually mean for me?
Of course. It's a totally normal reaction to when you read a headline like this to be concerned about either, you know, if you're a parent with a child in contact sport athletes currently, or you yourself are an aging adult who played high school football or lacrosse or any other sport, to be concerned that if 25% of this neuropathological change is the floor, you know, how is this going to affect me? What's my risk for dementia later on in life? So, of course, it's a totally natural reaction to be concerned about that. I think an important distinction from this study as it relates to Wisconsinites and just former athletes in general is the idea that we don't know how much these findings of this study translates or generalizes to other populations at lower levels of play. So the focus of this study is on the prevalence of CTE neuropathology. And what is the prevalence of former NFL players as it translates to former high school football players who, you know, played a couple years of youth football and maybe high school football? We don't know the prevalence of neuropathology in that group. So you don't want to take the findings from this study and say, well, 25% of everybody who played football at all levels is the floor, if that makes sense.
Does a study like this potentially complicate your job? What I mean by that is we have now an understanding that this may be very, very prevalent among certain types of players, but we still also don't have a way to test for CTE until after a person has passed away. And in the meantime, you have people who have a range of different symptoms, which may or may not be related to their football playing. And healthcare practitioners have to try to figure out what to do with that information and how to help treat the people in front of them.
Yes, absolutely. And in one way, it's more complicated than ever, to your point, because there's these findings that are published and people who are alarmed and worried and are experiencing symptoms. And so because we don't have a biomarker or a diagnostic marker of the prevalence of this pathology while people are living, although we're working on that now as part of our work at MCW, you know, in some ways, it's more complicated than ever because of that. But in other ways, it is relatively simple in the sense of if somebody's experiencing a symptom, it's a process of rule out or exclusion of other possible causes for that. That's something that we have learned in a lot of the research that we've conducted in older former athletes, whether NFL players or other contact sports, that we have found that a lot of times symptoms that people are experiencing, and even clinically, they can be due to a whole host of other factors other than their contact sport participation. And so we see things like reversible causes of dementia that can be detected with regular diagnostics and blood tests, things like metabolic disturbances, thyroid levels being off, B12. We see clinically people who are having cognitive difficulties, and typically that could be due to things like obstructive sleep apnea being undiagnosed and untreated. And we see often that people who just because they played football or played some other contact sport, they're experiencing symptoms. When they come in and get an evaluation and we find here are some other things, some etiologies that could be causing that, and we treat that, people can often get better. And so in some ways, it's more complicated to your point, but in other ways, it's simple of detect the symptom, kind of figure out what's going on, and then try to address it through the multiple other measures that we have to address it with.
We're talking about new research that confirmed over a 5-year period, at least one quarter of NFL athletes studied had the brain disease CTE. We're with Dr. Benjamin Brett, clinical neuropsychologist and associate professor of neurosurgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin. The lead author of this new study said that we know the source of the risk is the cumulative effect of hit after hit after hit. And he said, in a way, the silver lining here is that it means we can control the risk, for example, by limiting hits during practices. But is there always going to be a risk of head trauma and by extension CTE as long as players are delivering those big hits to each other during NFL games?
I think there's a couple things to think about in response to that sort of that risk and the source of the risk. And one is there's a lot of work being done right now. Some work that was done here as part of the CARE Consortium. We're a leader in a multi-site collegiate athlete study. And results from that found, for example, that the grand majority of repetitive head impacts that occur in a college season, especially during football, occur in the preseason during those kind of 2-a-day early preseason practices. And so as a result of that finding, there were some policy changes that were implemented that reduced the number of head impact changes to practice schedules and things like that. And so in one way, there are opportunities to reduce those repetitive head impacts through research and identification of not just time of the season, but position, personality types. There's all sorts of things that can result in repetitive head impacts, like tackling techniques, et cetera, that can be addressed through a prevention perspective. In addition to that, I would also say that it does need to be a cost-benefit analysis between some risk and benefit of contact sport participation. And so, you know, what is the degree of risk from contact sport participation for neurodegenerative diseases, and what level of contribution does that have for your risk of dementia later in life? And trying to weigh that on many of the benefits of contact sport participation, where, you know, in a world today where childhood obesity and lack of physical activity is extremely high, social isolation, you know, compared to playing on contact sport teams, you know, sports with friends and having that social component, there is an element of, you know, there is some risk in everything that we do in life. And so trying to understand, one, what is that risk? How big of a contribution of that exposure relates to adverse long-term outcomes? And then what is that risk relative to the potential benefits of that thing?
A moment ago, you were saying that there are things people can do right now that minimize the risks even after they've experienced head trauma. Say you've got a player in front of you who maybe is experiencing some of the symptoms that we associate with CTE. What do you have them try to see if that might help them address what they're dealing with?
A thorough evaluation really is an important part of that. Like other diagnostics that rule out other conditions that I mentioned earlier, like reversible causes of dementia, or, you know, kind of even treating depression with therapy or antidepressants, SSRIs or other things. But that is sort of addressing more of the immediate symptoms or kind of ruling out other things that could be causing difficulties that people are having. But another thing that I often address with people who come in clinically who are worried about their risk for dementia because they participated in a contact sport and read the headline is what we call modifiable health and lifestyle factors. And a lot of the research that I do here at the Medical College of Wisconsin is focused on this from a dementia perspective. We know there are a whole host of health and lifestyle factors not related to head injury history that can reduce an individual's risk of dementia independent of things like genetics and things like that. And so these are things like cardiovascular risk factors, sleep, even hearing loss, social isolation, depression. These are all things that we know can reduce your risk of dementia, whether you've had a history of head injury or not.
Of course, we're talking as the NFL is getting underway again. College football season is here. What would you like not only players and medical practitioners, but viewers and fans thinking about when it comes to CTE and the toll that these very popular games are potentially taking on the people who play them?
I think one of the most important things to consider is the incredible advancements in the detection methods, the return to play protocol progressions, and the player safety that has been identified and implemented over many years. And so what we call the modern clinical care model, where detection and diagnosis of concussion is better than ever, and people are able to be removed from sport as quickly as possible following an injury. And then they undergo what we call a gradual return to play progression, where they are guided through a gradual improvement and increase in physical activity and sport participation. And by the time they're returned to ready, by the time they're ready to return to sport, they have fully recovered, and there's a reduction of repeat concussion later on. And so all of these advancements that we've made toward player health and safety and how we kind of handle and diagnose and manage concussion and return to play is really important when thinking about the modern game and everybody kind of playing in today's time.
Dr. Brett, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Benjamin Brett is a clinical neuropsychologist and an associate professor of neurosurgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He talked to Brady Carlson about new data suggesting that traumatic brain injury disease CTE will affect at least a quarter of NFL athletes. Coming up, take a tour of Wisconsin's supper clubs with the author of a new guidebook to the Wisconsin tradition.
There are so many new supper clubs that have opened and are opening between last year and this year. It's really incredible.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. A new book from Wisconsin's Supper Club Guru takes readers through dozens of restaurants in all corners of the state and beyond. Ron Faola has written several books about Wisconsin supper clubs. As a filmmaker, he created Wisconsin Supper Clubs and Old Fashioned Experience. His newest book, Wisconsin Supper Clubs, One for the Road, sees the author chronicling his trips to 45 restaurants, including six outside of the state. Ron Faola joins us now. Ron, welcome to the show.
Hey, Rob. Glad to be here.
Now, this is your fifth book on supper clubs in and around Wisconsin. You've done some documentaries as well. Why are supper clubs a subject you love to keep coming back to?
Well, it's become a new career for me over the years, and I just really enjoy supper clubs. And when I did the movie, it kind of snowballed and things took off, and I got the book offer, and people liked the book so much, they asked for a second one. And so, just kind of kept going.
What is a supper club, right? How do you define it? What is the line between that's a restaurant over there, that's a supper club over here?
Yeah, that's the great big question. To me, you know, when you see it, but some of the elements are, it's family owned. The family often lives on the premises, so you're in their home. And that means that they have kind of different hours than maybe a chain restaurant. They're not open every day of the week. When they go hunting or fishing, they put a sign on the door, see you next week, kind of thing. The food is made from scratch. Sometimes the recipes are family recipes handed down over the generations. But, the food is American cuisine, steaks, chops, seafood, fish fry on Friday, prime rib on Saturday.
And it seems like part of the story with supper clubs is, yeah, they're going to be tourists maybe in from out of town, but it's also a place where if you go to your local one, you might run into your neighbors maybe every Friday or Saturday.
Absolutely. It's a community gathering place. So you'll see, like you say, your neighbors, or you'll make new friends at the bar. I find supper club bars are the most friendly places to strike up a conversation with somebody you don't know.
And I think sometimes people might think of supper club as, all right, it's an old thing. It's kind of a relic from the past. And going through your newest book, yeah, there are some with, you know, 100-year history, but also people are opening up new supper clubs or taking the old ones and putting new twists on them. This, as I'm reading your books anyway, this seems like a really live tradition, right? It's something that's growing and changing over time.
It really is. There are so many new supper clubs that have opened and are opening between last year and this year. It's really incredible. And the, supper clubs that have been around for a long time, like you say, some have been reopened or people are, their kids are taking over and there's, you know, they're keeping it going. But the popularity of supper clubs is driving that right now. And there's places that are even now calling themselves a supper club just to get more business.
Do you now? You mentioned there are a lot, some standard menu items. A lot of places have their own twists. Do you have a favorite order? Like you're trying a new supper club and you've got to try the blank. What is that?
If I want to, if I'm not sure of what I'm going to get, I'll usually go for prime rib or New York strip steak. If I see shrimp Dijon on a menu, I usually order it because I really like it, and you don't see it too much, especially north of Madison. It's a Chicago recipe, and it's quite unique.
And you say you've tried some odd foods over the years at some supper clubs, including chicken gizzards at the now-closed Schaefer's Supper Club by Krivitz. What are some of the more off-the-beaten-path foods you've had at supper clubs?
Well, I had deep-fried turtle, which was actual turtle meat, not a soup.
Not the shell.
No shell. No. It had a bone in it. That was kind of off-putting, but it was at the 3 Mile House in Hazel Green, and they actually catch them in the Mississippi River, and I think it was on Wednesdays was their turtle day, and now they're doing it again featuring turtle, and so that was pretty interesting. And yeah, the chicken gizzards, wasn't a big fan of those, although I went back a year later and they gave them to me cold and they weren't so as bad as they were when they were warm. But
now, one of the new supper clubs highlighted in the book is McGregor's Blink Bonnie, a tiny supper club, you write, in St. Germain in the Northwoods, new to your series, I should say. What makes that place special?
Well, McGregor's is a really small, like you say, a real tiny dining room in there and bar. And so people stand in line for hours waiting to get in. So that first group of people that get in and get the first tables are pretty lucky. And no matter what the weather, people are outside waiting to get in line. And they're known for their steaks and their kind of surf and turf. They used to do fried chicken, but they got rid of it because it took too long and nobody ordered it. So they're known, they come out and their steaks are on sizzle platters. So not only will you see it, but you'll hear it and smell the sizzle platter as they walk through the bar into the dining room. And I have the photo of the server walking through and the steam's coming up, and it's a great place to go.
And I qualified new to your book because you tried one time in the past. You wanted to interview the then owner. And what happened?
Yeah, I went in actually for supper on my own, and I was working on the second book or first book, I don't remember, but I was in the Minocqua area and I drove over there. And after the meal, I asked the bartender, I heard the owner was in the kitchen cooking, and asked if he would come out because I wanted to put him in my book, and he wouldn't come out and talk to me. So And then when I talked to his sons for this book, they said, yeah, that's Dad. He just was, you know, concentrating on working in the kitchen there.
And I love that. Seems like classic Wisconsin summer club. Yeah. Hey, your club could be featured in a new book. Eh, busy cooking.
Yeah. Exactly. I'm too busy cooking. Yeah.
We are talking about supper clubs in and around Wisconsin with Ron Faola, author of 5 books on supper clubs in Wisconsin. His latest is called Wisconsin Supper Clubs, One for the Road. Well, let's get back on the road now to Cashton. You highlight the Badger Crossing Pub and Eatery in the Driftless region. You say it's pretty different than a lot of the supper clubs you've visited. Paint us a picture.
Well, yeah, the inside is cavernous. You don't notice it from the outside, but there's the bar area. There's a 2-story ceiling, and there's a balcony above the bar too, and another bar upstairs. But it's real interesting. So they have this dining room in the front, and just they make a lot of pizzas, and but they also have a good salad bar, and they have the steaks and seafood. And I think on one of the nights they have burger night. So they feature kind of a burger with different toppings. And I just really had a good time when I was there. And I was meant to drive back that night, which I did, but I was kind of wishing I could have stayed around and spent the night in the area and hung out a little bit more at the bar.
And this, I mentioned, and we've talked about some are newer than others. This one just about 20 years old. What's the little bit of the story behind this, the Badger Crossing?
Yeah, they the couple that own it, Tim and Deb, they got it. And it has an actual really long history. It was a opera house at one point and a department store. And Cashton is an interesting town that's kind of up on a hill overlooking the valleys below in the Driftless area. And so it's a lot of farms and things, and the downtown isn't real huge. And again, it, you know, Badger Crossing is a gathering spot for the community. And it was real friendly and nice, and they have a really good atmosphere.
And when people think supper clubs in Wisconsin, they'll often connect it to the Prohibition era. And you say the Union Hotel in De Pere shows that influence. The building goes back before Prohibition. Tell us a little about the Union Hotel.
Right. Yeah. It's to me, it was like going back in time because of the dark wood paneling and the beautiful dining rooms that are different, decorated differently. And the bar, the nice big bar area with some tables, and the family that runs it has been there for generations, going back to almost day one. And the food is incredible, the just everything about it. And on top of that, it's a hotel, so there are rooms available upstairs. And they told me when there's a Packer game in town, they fill up. And we actually walked through all the rooms that were open, and they have a private dining room upstairs that used to be the owner's bedroom. So it's pretty interesting all around.
When I think of supper clubs, I don't have the experience that you do with them, but I've been to some. And one of my favorite things over the years was the relish tray, right? The veggies, pickled veggies, maybe cheese spread. It varies from place to place. But you write that the relish tray is becoming more and more a thing of the past. What's happening?
Well, the complimentary relish tray is a thing of the past. Ah. What they're doing now, they've moved it to the appetizer menu. So you're going to pay anywhere from a couple dollars to almost 30 from what I've seen on menu. So it gets, you know, maybe it's no longer, I mean, it's still maybe a relish tray, mm-hmm. but if they start adding sausage and deviled eggs, and then it's something else. But, you know, some places like the Duck Inn and Delavan, they charge, I think it's $2, and you get a real nice tray or dish of vegetables and dip. And to me, that's perfect. That makes you commit to it. You know, you're not going to, because that's the reason why they stopped doing the complimentary relish tray, was people weren't eating them and they were throwing the food away.
Gotcha. Oh, I don't mind paying a little bit for a good relish tray. What are some of your favorite things to show up on a relish tray, whether or not you're paying for it?
Yeah, well, you know, I like the carrots and celery, but maybe a pickle, black olives, nothing too fancy. If I'm not worried about talking to people, I'll have the green onions, you know. but, you know, whatever, just something healthy to snack on while you're trying to pick out the big cut of prime rib that you're going to have.
Now, you are mainly focusing on Wisconsin here. You've got some in the new book just across the border from Wisconsin. What led you to include our neighbors? Very generous of you. But what led you to bring them into the game here?
Well, in 2024, on my website, WisconsinSupperClubs.com, I have a club list where you can look up all the supper clubs in the state. And I decided to research and add supper clubs that were in our neighboring states. And so for this book, I decided it would be nice to go just over the border so it wasn't too long of a drive for anybody coming from Wisconsin to visit some of these supper clubs that are like what we have here. And so it turned out that, you know, there's two in Illinois, one in Iowa, and three in Minnesota.
Now, of course, part of the supper club experience you mentioned is the bar part of it for the most part. And the old fashioned, the brandy old fashioned is the characteristic drink. Do you have any favorite twists on the old fashioned that you've encountered, whether it's in the new book or just over the years?
Yeah, I had a Southern Comfort old fashioned.
Oh, so cool old fashioned. I've had that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I'm not really a big bourbon fan, but at the Jackson Grill in Milwaukee, when Heidi Schmidt and Jimmy Jackson owned it, Heidi made me a bourbon old fashioned that had a different flavor to it. And she said, well, even if you don't like bourbon, you're going to like it. And I really did enjoy it. But in a regular brandy old fashioned sweet, it was what I normally order. Mm-hmm. I like blue cheese olives.
Ooh, that sounds like a good touch.
Yeah.
Now, Ron, as we wrap up, for people who haven't checked out Wisconsin Supper Club tradition, can you give a little pep talk to go and check out one either near them or next time they're on the road?
Yeah, go to my list on WisconsinSupperClubs.com. And the state is in the five regions of the book, plus then the Midwest neighbors. And if you're going to be in a certain region, like the Southeast or Northwest or whatever, you can look up places to go, and there's a map that is on there as well, and it gives you all the information you need. Their address, that you can click on their name, it'll take you to their website or Facebook page, and explore, enjoy.
Ron, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Ron Faola has written several books on Wisconsin Supper Clubs. His fifth one, Wisconsin Supper Clubs One for the Road, is scheduled to be released on September 8th. Just took a tour of Wisconsin supper clubs, and we want to hear from you. Were supper clubs part of your family tradition back in the day, or are they part of your now? Email your supper club story to wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text at 888-642-0232. Do you have a favorite supper club, past or present? A favorite supper club food or drink? Have you worked at one, or are you part of a family that has owned one? Again, we'd love to share your story. So email at wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text. The number is 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Royce Podeswa, and Trevor Hook. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.